After 18 years back there, I got this call from Bridge Golding. He said, well, before that happened, I should go back just a second. I began to worry. I had seen what happened to faculty who had stayed too long at the same institution. And I was afraid I was going to become, what I say, become part of the woodwork. We had some older professors there, and it's true, they hadn't kept on research, but their teaching had got out of date, and they had lost interest in their jobs. The enthusiasm seemed to wane, and I figured they had been the same place too long. Now, 18 years is a long time for an active researcher to be at one institution. And Margaret and I got to do some travel. We got bit by the traveling bug. And even then, the salaries for full professors were not all that great. And the living expenses were not very high there. But, you know, the kids were graduating. They were going to go to school. We had Margaret Ann's parents were out here getting older, and my parents were out here, and they were getting older. And we found out every time we'd go on vacation, we'd come out here to kind of look after them. And so it just became obvious to me that we probably ought to make a change. We ought to go to California. I always wanted to get back to California. Margaret Ann had been raised out here, and she loved the small town atmosphere back in West Lafayette. But so we thought, we tried. By this time, I Seaborg had asked me if I wanted to come to Berkeley. And so I had an opportunity to go to Berkeley. And while he wanted me there, the faculty thought I overlapped their faculty too much, and they would do it if he insisted. And I told him I didn't want to come with those. He was chancellor by that time. I didn't want to come when the chancellor put me in. He said, I want you to come as vice chancellor of research. And I said, but the faculty don't want me, Glenn, and you don't want somebody that isn't an active researcher being your vice chancellor of research. And so I didn't.
Okay.
Well, then I got this phone call from Bridge Golding. Oh, no, before that, the chemistry department asked me if I had wanted to come out to
San Diego State. Okay.
No, I had a lecture. Okay.
Okay, should I put it on?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the jobs that I had at Purdue, which was very nice because I could travel out to the West, was to visit some of the universities on the West Coast and give lectures about my research and talk about the university. And I used to start at San Diego State, and it's where I had contacts at Long Beach State, USC, Berkeley, and University of Washington. And I wouldn't catch them all every year, but I would do them. But I try to do San Diego each year, and I got my way paid out here so I could stop and see folks and relatives in San Diego. And one of the times out here, I was asked, when I was lecturing at... to back up a little bit, they had asked me at San Diego State on one of my lecture tours at San Diego when I gave lectures if I'd be interested in coming out to San Diego State as chair of the department. Well, I didn't think so. And I said, I don't think so. And I said, well, why don't you think about it, and you can talk to us later. And I said, you can find somebody, I think. I said, I'm not coming out here to be a chemist if I were to come. I wouldn't want to come to be a chemist, and that's what you want me to do is do chemistry, and I don't think I want to be a department chair. And so the next time I came out, now I have to think very carefully about the sequence. Before I came the next time, I had gotten a call from Bridge Golding, said, Jim, I'd like you to come out and be my graduate dean. And I said, I don't know what a graduate dean is like. All I had been on the graduate council at Purdue, and I knew the graduate dean at Purdue. And in fact, I had an opportunity to get in that path to do administration at Purdue. Mm-hmm. And I had turned it down. I thought, well, I've been at Purdue. I'm doing very well as a teacher and researcher, and I don't necessarily have to take on administrative duties. But I knew in the back of my mind we were going to have to probably go out to California one way or somehow. So I just said, well, let me think it over. Mm-hmm. And when Brage Golding called me, and I said, well, I'll think it over, Brage. And then I said, let me know more about it. And he said, well, this is my first year here, and I've got all these positions to fill. So he said, I'll get in contact with you. In the meantime, in the fall, I started my regular recruiting trip. This was in the fall of 72. Mm-hmm. And I was started San Diego State, and I gave my lecture. And they said, well, you know, one of the important chemists was on the selection committee for one of the administrative positions, because Brage Golding had inherited a group of acting administrators. Mm-hmm. Because the main reason for that Malcolm Love, who had been the much beloved president before him, wanted to retire, and the faculty kept saying, no, you can't retire. And so as administrative positions fell vacant, he just didn't fill them with permanent people, put acting in. So what Brage inherited was a group of acting mm-hmm. administrators, and he thought that was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. So apparently he got in contact, or the chemist got in contact with him, and the first thing I knew was over in Brage's office. And we agreed that I would come out on a formal visit in the spring. And I said, fine, we'll do that. I went back home. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, Brage Golding seems to have some interest in it and in me. And I said, I don't know whether we want to go back to San Diego or not. And Margaret Ann was noncommittal. But that spring, I got another call from him. I said, I want you to come out and interview be the graduate dean. So I said, well, I have to bring Margaret Ann. And so we flew out here. And I went for a long day visit and talked to various people. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the graduate dean was more of a housekeeping job. Oh. He see that the students filled out the forms, that they went into the various procedures the right way. He presided at the graduate council. Mm-hmm. He sat on the Senate, but he didn't seem to be very influential. And the graduate council, the Senate had essentially taken over and worked directly with the president, leaving out the graduate dean and the graduate council, which I hadn't been used to. And so when I talked to Brage, I said, and Brage, the research function is different from the graduate function. And you know at Purdue, they were intimately tied up together. Mm-hmm. And Brage said, well, the research function is largely under the auspices of the San Diego State University Foundation. And he said, so if you want to do that, I'm thinking about a change in leadership over there, so I'll make you the vice president of the foundation. And as what you can accomplish with the graduate council and the Senate, you'll have to figure that out for yourself. So after a long day, essentially he offered me the job. Mm-hmm. It's funny, after I accepted and came out, I had to fill out an application form to keep the books clean. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I'll think about it, Brage. And I went back and we had a family meeting in West Lafayette, sitting around the dinner table one night, and I said, well, what shall we do? Mm-hmm. And the children would have preferred that we stayed in West Lafayette. Where all their friends were.
Right, everything. That's usual.
Although I said, but you guys are going to go to college and you'll leave home and there are no jobs here in West Lafayette, so you'll have to leave us. Eventually you won't be here. Mm-hmm. And but they were thinking in a more immediate time.
Right. And that's very usual.
In the meantime, Margaret Ann's father had had a heart attack.
Oh.
And their health was beginning to deteriorate.
Mm-hmm.
She was the last child, and they were much older than she was. I mean, there was a generation and a half between her parents' age and her age. And so we finally decided we ought to take the job.
Mm-hmm.
But I talked to Brage and asked him, one, could I keep up my consulting? Mm-hmm. Two, yes. Two, could I keep up my research? And three, could I try to make something out of the job? And he said, I want you to, yes, you do all those things. So I took the job, and September, that was in, I would say in 73, that must have been in June that all that came to a head.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had to sell the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the meantime, back at West Lafayette, I had had the opportunity to take my summers off because at Purdue had put me on a 12-month salary but didn't expect me to do anything during the summer except to do my research.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the kind of a custom for many of the faculty at Purdue to go someplace during the summer, and mm-hmm. many of them would head north into Michigan where it was cooler on the lakes.
Mm-hmm.
But we had learned about Lake Tahoe a long time ago. And so I said, why don't we go out to Lake Tahoe and I had gotten some money, some various awards and so forth, and see if we can buy a little place up on Lake Tahoe. You know, like for $3,000 or $4,000 right on the lake, a nice mm-hmm. beautiful cabin. Well, we talked to a real estate agent up there, and we found a beautiful, furnished architect home, not on the lake, but up, and there was a drive around, so there was a lake, and there's some houses, and we were one level above that. Furnished
mm-hmm.
on a tax sale, which I think we bought for $30,000, and we made the down payment, so we owned that property up at Lake Tahoe.
Oh, my.
And so we had been coming out there in the summers, and the children got used to it, and so when we packed all of our stuff.
Yeah.
We sent the movers out, and it had to be put in storage, and we told them that we would take everything out around the 1st of September.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove out here. We had two cars by then in a four-driver family, and we drove to San Diego and stayed with my mother
mm-hmm.
on West Robinson Street. And the children were anxious to get up to Lake Tahoe, and we wanted to buy a house, so we gave ourselves a week.
That
a stupid thing to do. Everyone told us where we should live. Well, you don't want to... Margaret Ann's parents thought, being very practical mind, we ought to live out by the university. Del Cerro, they said, there's some pretty place to live. Martin and I wanted to live out of La Jolla. I had courted her here. We had come here. Her mother thought, it's just damp out here. Why do you want to live in a beach town for?
Oh,
it's damp out here. And Martin had friends that said Point Loma is a beautiful place, and other people said I forget the area, but if you go west from Hillcrest, you run into Mission Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very pretty place to use. But we held out for La Jolla. So we came out here, and we had the sale for our check in hand, you know. I put it in the local bank, and I said, we want to buy a house. We want to buy it in a hurry. I can't pay more than about $80,000 for it, which seemed to me a reasonable price. And so we spent a week. We went through one agent, didn't work, and then went and got the present agent, Dorothea Rodeman. Dorothea, D-O-R. Well, you can...
I know that.
Dorothea Rodeman.
Right.
She was our agent, and she found the house on the corner here. And we parked in front of this house and walked down here, and Marianne saw that gate, and she looked in, and she said, that's the kind of house I want. And so she said, let me go talk to the lady. It was on the market and taken over. And so she went in and talked to Mrs. Paul. This is the Paul residence.
Isn't that something?
Dr. Paul was one of the founding physicians of Scripps Medical Institute, which became Scripps Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so within a day or two, we closed the deal.
That's fabulous.
And what helped close it is that we were willing to let her continue to occupy the house. Or put another way, the escrow wasn't effective until that first week in September. Mm-hmm. So she could stay here, and yet she knew the house was sold. And then we went up to talk to Lake Tahoe, and we dreamed about what we were going to do. We came down, the furniture was shipped over, we moved in the house, and that was our move.
Terrific.
So Margaret Ann was busy trying to arrange the house.
Oh, yeah.
With some of the Lafayette furniture, and of course we didn't have a lot, and people started to give us things, and over the years we've added various things, but
it's beautiful.
The house came with the carpets all in it, and it came with drapes, and although we've changed them since, and so everything that you see was bound around the basic plan. And Margaret was a gardener, and she got busy and started redoing the outside. She was a very good gardener, and she had to have some help, some tree trimmers and so forth. But anyway, that's the end of the house. Meanwhile, I was out at the university.
Mm-hmm.
In the university, I didn't know very much about, except I had been out there at San Diego State. It wasn't ever a sleepy place, and the fact that we were always very active, but it was a small place.
Mm-hmm.
And so the nature of it had changed a great deal.
Yes.
It was no longer a small college. And the year I got there, they had changed the name officially from San Diego State. Well, it had mm-hmm. changed some years ago from San Diego State College to California State College at San Diego, but they prevailed on the legislature to write in the law that its name was San Diego State College.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was here before the system was here.
Mm-hmm.
And then they wanted to get the name changed, and so the system was proceeding to change its names. It was become the California State Colleges and University,
mm-hmm.
the CSU. And to make a long story short, the faculty and the students, the local politicians changed our name to San Diego State University, and there it's been ever since.
Right.
And it was a university. There was no doubt about it. It was because it turned out, besides a wide range of bachelor's degree programs, by the time I get here, more and more of the professional schools, it mm-hmm. turned out you had to have a master's degree in order to advance in your area.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started giving master's degrees some time ago. So all my job was to try to get a functioning graduate council and to try to learn something about what was going on in the departments. So I talked the Senate and the Dean's administration into doing what we set up, the academic review process, wherein you bring in a team of outside visitors, and these visitors tell you what they think about the department in a written report, and then the department responds to it. And that gives the Senate and the administration some insight as to whether departments should add graduate degrees. Every department thought they ought to add a graduate degree as a status symbol,
mm-hmm.
and that turned out, I think, to be a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly because more departments wanted joint doctoral programs now, and those take a lot of money, and at the time you had to go to the legislature and get special funding for them. So I worked out the academic review process, and we put it into place, and the Senate agreed to it, and the President agreed to it, and it started the fall of 74.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I had to do something about a graduate council that was ineffective. There was a curriculum committee of the Senate,
mm-hmm.
and whatever the graduate council did, they would send it to the curriculum committee of the Senate, then the curriculum committee would do what they want and send to the Senate, and so the graduate council had very little influence on it. It was just another layer of bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I appointed a committee. By that time, I had learned who the key faculty members were.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all active in research and graduate affairs, and they were And I talked to the chair of the Senate, mm-hmm. and so it was a lot of help. The chair of that committee was a very, very influential and one of the finest faculty members I've ever known here. Harriet Kopp is her name. And Harriet was chair of the speech pathology and audiology department.
Mm-hmm.
And she had come from Columbia out here and wanted to get away from New York and was modernizing the department. And so she agreed to chair the committee made up of leading faculty and scientists and scholars from the university. And they proposed, at the end of the first year I was here in 1973, a new charter for the Graduate Council.
Mm-hmm.
And the new charter, they would essentially take over final approval for all curriculum and coursework and things like that from the Senate, subject only to the review by the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And the president, if they did that, the president agreed to give up the appointment of the Graduate Council, and they would have to be elected by the Senate as a major committee. And it was some struggle to get it through,
mm-hmm.
but we finally got it through. And so by my beginning of my second year, we had two places, two major things to do.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go into all the details, but the fact of the matter is, the university was growing very quickly. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the resources to grow. We had to depend a lot on the faculty bringing in outside money
mm-hmm.
through contracts and grants, and they did. Since during my tenure there, they brought in over $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's money that we had that a lot of other schools didn't have. And it was only the hard work of the faculty. They just were marvelous. I was influential in getting the graduate students' salaries raised for TAs and graduate assistants so they could offer financial assistance to better graduate students. I made it my job to learn about the graduate deans at some of the other universities where our faculty had context for joint doctoral programs, and we finally had 12 or more when I left, and now they're up to 14, 15, 16. I have no idea. They're going to have quite a few more. We survived the budget crisis of the 90s. Frazier Golding then made me vice president of the foundation.
Yeah. What about that?
Which is kind of his representative at the foundation, and I was the presiding officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I hired a new general manager for the foundation, who turned out to be really, really very, very good.
Who was that?
His name was Harry Albers. And Harry Albers assembled a staff and knew how to manage, and he was well-liked and respected, particularly by the deans and the faculty and the president. And of course, it was kind of interesting. When I first came to Brage Golding, he said, "No, I want you to stay at least 5 years. I can't force you to. I want you to stay at least 5 years." He said, "You can't accomplish anything." And he said, he inferred I was a well-sought-after property.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know I wanted to stay in San Diego. A well-sought-after property. So I said, "I want you to stay a while, not just come and move on."
Mm-hmm.
And because I'd been chair of what's essentially a department at Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't been a dean.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't been a vice president or anything. And here I suddenly found myself on the president's cabinet and giving policy direction to the foundation. And 3 years after I had been there, the rumor went around that Brage Golding was looking for another job. And it kind of unnerved me a little bit. But Brage was a very independent, wonderful person. He fought hard for the university. He would try to keep the chancellor from making us do things we didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good representative up in the legislature. But it wore him down. Because
mm-hmm.
he had to meet up there every month. And I went up there to one of the meetings one time, and he did not like the leadership in the chancellor's office of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 5 years, they call him back. They call him to Ohio. He had, before he came here, he had helped found a university back there,
mm-hmm.
which was Kent State.
No, Wright University.
Wright University. And when Kent State got in all the problems,
mm-hmm.
The trustees of the Ohio system asked him to come back and be president of Kent State to try to solve the problem they were having, which were the student riots.
Right.
You remember they wanted to build a memorial gymnasium with the spot where the students were killed. And they wanted something to be, they wanted to build a gymnasium there. And the students wanted some memorial built there to the students. And he said, after giving it some thought, we'll build a memorial gymnasium so we can have a gymnasium and honor the students as well. And after that, things settled out at Kent State. He was very good at that. He really was very good at that. And I remember the first year he was here, they had, you know, their student riots were going on and liberal professors were leading him. And he met and talked with the students out in the outside administration building. And he was a no-nonsense person, but the person believed him. He was a man of high integrity,
mm-hmm.
and he was very smart. And so he got along well here. Faculty liked him. He had brought in quite a few change administrators. He brought in an academic vice president, Trevor Colburn,
mm-hmm.
who turned out to be a wonderful vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought in a lot of different people. Some of them went on to be presidents and vice presidents on their own. So, I owe what success I have to the administration, to Brazier giving me this opportunity. In 78, Tom Day came.
Mm-hmm.
Brazier retired. Now, let's see, he retired after 5 years, so it was not in 78. In 78, we had an acting president. Trevor Colburn became acting
right.
president in 79, I think, when Tom Day came. Do I have my dates right?
I think Tom Day came in 78, actually.
Well, that was in 77 they left.
And Brage Golding finished in 72. No, he didn't. No. But I think it was 78. Well,
I'm not so sure about the dates. And Day was an entirely different kind of an administrator. He was very smart. He knew how to do with faculty. He liked the administration he inherited. He supported the foundation. He supported research.
Mm-hmm.
He was a no-nonsense administrator and used to scare us half to death most of the time. His bark was louder than his bite, because I don't remember he ever firing anybody. But the way he snarled at you sometimes, you might think. But I came to administer admire his administration. He never got along with the faculty as well as Brazier Golding. And one of the first things that hit him, of course, in the 90s was this terrible budget crisis when they
mm-hmm.
literally pulled 30 or 40% of the money out in 1 year. And so he said, we're going to have to let people go. I'm not just going to cut everybody across the board. And so he gave, I think, 90 or 100 faculty, people who held tenure as faculty, including me,
mm-hmm.
notices of termination. And I was safe because I was an administrator, but I had faculty tenure.
Mm-hmm.
That's something Brazier Golding agreed to, that you would not hire any administrators that didn't have faculty tenure, which was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that all ended in a turmoil which I'm the least qualified to talk about, but it did not interrupt the major function of the university, which is proceed. And we were, as soon as the budget was restored, we were able to hire good faculty. The student enrollment grew. We got new programs, and I think largely to his forceful leadership. Brazier Golding amplified on the path that Love had laid out,
mm-hmm.
and said, we're going to be a real university now,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to have doctoral programs and research. Day took that up and made it the centerpiece of his administration.
Mm-hmm.
And when he retired, we had a new president came in that said that and more so.
Mm-hmm.
And so each one has built on the other one, and I've been privileged to watch that. And so
Well, clearly you were doing more than watching because they all appreciate what you were doing.
Well, they had four different chances to fire me along the way because each new president came in and said, I want my own man. And
how did the foundation change over the years?
Well, the foundation just became, in two or three ways, it became larger because as the faculty got more and more contract and grant money, you have to have more administrators to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
People think you just write a letter to Washington and say, send me some money. And, of course, it's a very complicated job. Right now, it has to be all done on a computer in a certain format and everything like that. But I think that the foundation was able to expand, but the main thing the foundation did during my tenure was we ran out of room.
Mm-hmm.
Faculty had these ideas, and they could get more research money. We had no space.
Mm-hmm.
The university was largely built, we thought, in those days, and we had no space. So the foundation had to start accumulating property. And the first thing they did was get the property down by Alvarado Hospital, down there, along the Alvarado Road.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought buildings down there, and we moved researchers in there and clinics in there. We have one of the best speech and audiology clinics probably in the world down there. And I can't tell you all the details. And then it turned out that the public health people needed space, and so we would rent here. And we went, we needed facilities for rehabilitation counseling, which took workrooms. You train people how to train disabled people to work on machinery and things like that.
Right.
We've been all over town.
Oh.
And that took, the foundation could borrow money and then pay it off, while the federal government would not pay money to build physical facilities. So we just take it out of our indirect and turn around and use it for that. And and what was left over, we could put the indirect back in the university to sponsor research.
Mm.
While if we had given it to the university in those days, we couldn't have spent it for capital.
Ah.
It had to go on to become the part of the budget that goes through Sacramento. And so we were able to keep it separate. And President Day fought tooth and toenail to keep it that way.
Yeah.
And it still is that way, by the way. But the property development, some people began to think it was the tail wagging the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And the foundation over the years had bought pieces of property that came available right north of the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so one time thought that maybe the way to do is try to make some big money to help the university, because the demands by the faculty, legitimate demands, were getting larger and larger and larger. And so Mr. Albers, who was the general manager of the foundation, came up with a plan where we would have a property development, putting up resident apartments and business places, and rent that out.
Mm-hmm.
We'd borrow the money and rent it out, and what excess was left over we would then use for the university. And including what they used to say, theaters and bowling alleys and liquor stores. Well, no liquor stores. We didn't really want a bowling alley. But you've seen, there are many universities have had property developed around their around their edges, and some have been quite successful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Tom Day retired, President Weber came in.
Mm-hmm.
He actually came a few months before Tom retired. And just while they were building the new administration, a new administration building, which was to be called, which is now called Manchester Hall.
Mm-hmm.
We used to call it Centennial Hall because we dedicated it our centennial. And he had a card table in a big empty room otherwise with a phone. That's where his office. And so we had a lot of discussions about where the direction of the university, what it should go. And I agreed with that, and he agreed how we were doing things. And so, lo and behold, he made me a vice president of research.
Right.
It was the fifth vice president the university had then.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a highlight of my career. And in the meantime, over the years, my salary had been going up very nicely, so I could afford the houses that I had. And to cap it all off, what a wonderful life I've had at the university due to two things. Three, my understanding wife, because I was working hard when she was here at home. An understanding faculty who was able to me to give what leadership skills I had, mm-hmm. and a wonderful set of presidents.
That's really
nice. And, you know, for someone in my business, you look back, it can't be any better than that.
Isn't that lovely?
Can't be any better than that.
Yeah, but clearly it's what you bring to the situation, and it's a...
Well, we're synergistic, I guess, yeah. Right. We work back and forth, but I was a faculty member, and I always believed that the strength of the university is in the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always thought that was the important thing. I was there to serve the faculty. Now, that doesn't mean individual faculty, so that means you have to work with the faculty and their committees.
Mm-hmm.
But even individual faculties, I try to have help.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, a faculty member would lose a grant, and I could find the money to carry them over till the grant became active. One of our best-known researchers was going to get out of it, and two or three of them, I kept them going. And one of them brought in $3 million after that.
Mm.
She was really, really very, very good. But the whole university was filled with good faculty. And the academic review process let the faculty themselves know, and administration, how they were doing with their resources, mm-hmm. and where they needed key resources, and what faculty they needed, and were they promoting people, recommending promotion for people too fast, and the faculty... It caused them some effort and work to do it, but in some cases we were able to move significantly,
mm-hmm.
with reason. Otherwise, the budget process was just kind of divvy it up and everybody gets a chunk of it, you know, kind of based on history.
Yeah.
And the administrators now don't do that. It depends on what you produce and what you can get by with it. So that review process took a lot of my time and my staff's time. I would say a third of my time went into that review, mm-hmm. process and interpreting, and I'm working with the Senate and the faculty. A third of my term being a graduate dean, a third of my time overseeing the foundation. So that's cool.
What about the student body over that time?
Well, one of the things, of course, my own research then slowly died.
Mm-hmm.
I brought out a group of four or five people. I've never had more than one or a postdoc ever since then.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished my 50th PhD student, you know, a year after I retired.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. But, so my own research suffered, but I didn't come out here to be an electron researcher primarily. I came out here to help the university.
Mm-hmm.
Being a researcher might help myself, but it soon became clear I didn't have time to be active at the same level,
mm-hmm.
and still do what the presidents want me to do at the university. And I liked administration. I threw myself into it, and I
mm-hmm.
liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with it, of course, is like being a faculty member. It never ends. There's always something to do.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, my wife managed our home, and what a beautiful home she has made out of it.
It is so beautiful.
And we've been able to help our children, and they've got good starts now. And interesting how things come around.
Mm-hmm.
But Catherine is now a permanent lecturer out of San Diego State in rhetoric and writing, and she's written four or five textbooks.
How wonderful.
Wonderful. Her husband is a professor at Mesa College. My son and his wife are in the foundation. They work in the foundation.
Oh, my.
He's a computer guru, and she's one of the people that help the faculty get their proposals ready, because it is very complicated.
Oh, yes.
And the budgeting questions. And she said, well, she can say, I wouldn't try that National Science Fund. They won't give you money for that. But what you could do,
mm-hmm.
is do this and this, and maybe get the university to help this, and we could help you that. I mean, she puts together those packages for the faculty.
Terrific.
That's invaluable.
Absolutely.
Nobody at Purdue ever showed me how to do that.
Yeah.
I learned the hard way.
No, I can appreciate that.
And so she is very, very good at that.
Terrific.
And my son is very, very good at that, particularly when something happens to my computer.
He's
good enough, he can tell me on the phone what to do. Doesn't even have to come over here.
That's terrific. And do you have grandchildren?
I have two grandsons and two step-granddaughters.
Okay.
My son married a woman that already had two daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he married, he got a family quick. He didn't have to go through all the diapers and everything. And they're all very, very dear people. And we get together on holidays all together. And last Christmas, we were down at the La Valencia Hotel, sitting there looking out, having Christmas dinner over the whole bay. I thought, how lucky can a man be? And the only bad thing ever happened in my life was that my wife died prematurely.
Yeah.
She died at 75. We had been married almost 50 years.
Oh,
and it's hard to function after that.
Yeah.
But, you know, her spirit's still here, and every time I look at something, I can think of where she bought that, you know, where she got that.
It's so beautiful. I was thinking that I love doing oral histories, but at this moment, I wish I were doing a video history, because it's just so beautiful, and being surrounded by all of this.
Faculty?
Right.
You know?
Okay, I'm going to talk. This has been so interesting, and it's great to get your perspective on the years that you described. Sitting here and in this beautiful setting, of course, has enhanced the situation for me, but I'm so appreciative and honored that you have granted this interview, and I know that it will be a very important addition to the oral history collection at San Diego State University. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Susan. It's been my privilege to talk to you. But people who are listening to this should understand, it's just my point of view. And I was just one of a number of people who were here doing, I would say, probably the greatest change in the university that's taken place in most institutions. And so it's been a privilege to be part of that, and I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to say something about it.